Court. We'll proceed to the second case of the day, Nemsky versus ConocoPhillips Company. Mr. Barron.
May it please the Court, Mr. Widmer, Mr. Cooper. My name is Lee Barron. I have the pleasure of representing Mr. Tom Nemsky in this rather unique 301 action. Mr. Nemsky was, as of September of 2006, a 22-year exemplary employee of the Wood River Refinery in Wood River, Illinois. He was a member of Local 399, which had a collective bargaining agreement with ConocoPhillips.
I wonder if you could clarify two things for
sure.
Me, Mr. Barron. The 2004 policy on substance abuse that ConocoPhillips issued, as I understand it, was issued under its management rights clause or whatever of the collective bargaining agreement. And it, I thought it just said, we're going to treat, among other things, having a 0.040 result as cause for immediate termination. But that policy didn't say anything about the arbitration or grievability. Okay, so that just is issued, and it defines immediate cause to terminate. It's not until the 2005 memorandum that there's at least a purported, I realize you're challenging, but a purported agreement between the union and the company to restrict Sections 18 and 20 of the CBA. Is that right?
You have gone right to the heart of the matter, Your Honor. Yes. Their HR person testified to the same thing. I asked them exactly that question. They say zero tolerance in the drug policy they issued.
That's the 2004 policy.
Correct. They say that we're going to have a zero tolerance. If you have 0.04, you're out the door.
So if the day after that policy had been enacted, Mr. Nemsky had the exact same things happen to him, you could have just grieved it, gotten before an arbitrator, presented your arguments about false positives or whatever else you wanted to present, and there would have been a result.
Exactly. In fact, there were two people pending.
Those two people.
Smith and Feuer were pending under exactly that. And what the union, that is the memorandum, entering into the memorandum of agreement in 2005 is what we say is outside the wide range of reasonableness. It was ludicrous to give away what you just described Smith and Feuer had. And Smith and Feuer were headed to arbitration. They, if they had viable grievances that were with merit, they would have been reinstated by an arbitrator.
So here's my problem with this theory then. The collective bargaining agreement itself is an agreement, obviously, between the employer and the union. And as I see the 2005 MOA, it's essentially an amendment to the CBA. And sometimes unions are able to negotiate good CBAs, and sometimes unions aren't so effective, and they negotiate bad CBAs. And presumably, if they're bad enough, maybe the employees toss them out as a union and bring in somebody else, or they do something. But I don't see how the company did anything wrong by asking for what it wanted in the 2005 agreement. It wanted to get rid of arbitration for these. I don't know what rule they violated to ask for that.
I don't think they violated it. It's not our position that it was wrong of them to ask for that. This collective bargaining agreement still had, you can only be terminated for just cause, and it still had the provision in it that an arbitrator makes that determination. The company basically asked the union, Local 399, hey, give away this critical provision.
I get it, and the union did. So what I'm having trouble is getting that action of the union into the box of a hybrid 301 action. Because, it may mean, your argument is if it's a negotiation problem, then you don't have to find any violation by the company. But I can't find any authority for that. and I can't see why the remedy is a 301 action as opposed to the kind of more democratic remedy, if you will, that I'm talking about, that maybe this is just not an effective union anymore.
Throw the bums out type of... It's still 301, and I think I made the point in my brief that the Airline Pilots Association was a case where only the union was named as a defendant in that case.
Isn't there a difference, though? I mean, yes, only the union's named as a defendant, but it was my understanding of the law that in order to prevail against the union, you still did have to show that the company had violated, even if you weren't trying to pursue actual relief against them. And, of course, the airline pilot's case sort of fizzles off in the end because it's just the court decides there's no problem with what the union did.
Well, and when I started here, one of the things I said was that this was a somewhat unique case because I think that is another issue in this. If you are faced with a situation where we alleged a client was fired without just cause, and we find out later that the union entered into a ridiculous, irrational agreement, Mr. Nemski, after 22 years, is still out without his job. He doesn't have any. He's not even a member of the union anymore. He doesn't have any standing. Everybody else is going on down the road. If he's going to have a remedy for his loss of that just cause provision and the damages that flow from that, it's going to be only under 301 against the union. Now, maybe, and the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court has said that we proportion damages. It may be that the answer to your question is that 100% of his damages are attributable to the union, and that the company, under that fact scenario, the company, they, you know, the world of labor negotiations certainly can't be limited by somebody, you know, throwing up a trial balloon that nobody should accept.
But tell me why your rule wouldn't lead us into a world where every time a union caves into a company on some provision and negotiates a bad clause in a CBA, people don't have a cause of action against the union for a fair representation point.
Well, because the Supreme Court precedent is that they still have this wide range of reasonableness. It's only going to be the ludicrous agreement. You give away...
But in whose eyes? I mean, you know, it seems to me there are all sorts of things that companies might achieve that somebody somewhere might think is just a totally unjustifiable provision.
I might disagree with that because I think that this case goes to two critical provisions. There's two things. We asked the union representatives at their deposition, what do you do when you're organizing? Two things we do. We negotiate for wages and benefits, and we protect our employees from being terminated, having their employment terminated for without just cause. And then they turn around and give away one of the critical things. I think your question would be, let's say that they irrationally decide that, you know, vacations, something related to vacations, or uniforms, or something of that sort. That's a tangential matter, and it would not be appropriate, I think, and I don't think we would have any type of claim in that type of situation. But when we're at the heart and soul of what a union does or is supposed to do for the people it represents, what it sells itself as doing, and it gives that away, I don't think we're going to be opening up the door and letting in lots of other suits. I think that this case is going to be an exception to the rule, and if anything, it's not going to open it up. It's going to make unions perhaps, if there's any concern, be a little more careful that, you know, wait, let's move slowly. Let's not, you know, give away critical issues. But I don't think there's any indication when you look at the case law that there's some slippery slope, that 301 cases are easy cases. From a plaintiff's point of view, they are tough cases.
Let me ask you this then. Let's assume we jump over all of these difficulties. Can you point to specific evidence in the record that would support Mr. Nemski's allegation that this was a false positive, other than essentially his word for it that he hadn't been drinking?
Well, first of all, with all respect, I wouldn't just be dismissive of his word at this stage, at a summary judgment stage.
Did you show, for example, how long would Robitussin stay in somebody's system, or what would be the result for this kind of test for somebody who had inhaled that cleaner, or, you know, things like that?
By the time I get into the case, the things that he inhaled are all gone. He's off property.
Sure, but you could run a test of somebody and say, drink this much Robitussin and let's blow into the breathalyzer. I don't know. I mean, is there anything like that?
Yes, there is, Your Honor. In fact, Ms. Denner, the nurse, was asked specifically, could mouthwash give a false positive? And she says anything that can have alcohol in it could give a false positive. And
they said, is 15 minutes apart, though?
The question was asked, could it give a false positive? And she said, yes. And the DOT, by the way, you know, does, what do they call them, medical review officers. There's no medical review officer. There's all sorts of ways inside other proceedings to check to see whether or not the result is reliable. So we have the Robitussin there. Is it still in his teeth? Is it in his mouth? Is it enough? Because it's not like it's in its blood. It's in his mouth that the Robitussin.
It's in his blood. I mean, I realize you're making the argument he was faced with an impossible choice. Go get the blood test or have the urinalysis, and couldn't do both.
And that's absolutely right, and the facts support that. But I guess my main point is that he was deprived of the opportunity to present just that argument. If I could bring Mr. Nevsky here and you all got an opportunity to see him, you'd say, wow, this is a guy we believe. And we don't believe the reliability of these tests. There's nothing super magical about numbers on a piece of paper that you're going to say, you know, you may be persuaded by the numbers on a piece of paper. You may not. Once you have an opportunity to listen to Mrs. Denner talk about what she did and what Mr. Nevsky says he didn't, you're going to choose. And you're going to say, we don't believe her. We do believe him. We've never had that opportunity. After 22 years of exemplary work, this guy's out the door without even an opportunity to have an arbitrator decide whether there is just cause. The other point that I have on just cause is that's only one piece of the just cause analysis. Even if, arguendo, there was 0.043 in his system, that's not the end of the just cause analysis. The just cause analysis requires all the things that were referenced in Clear Channel, March of this year. That's the case. I don't need to tell you that a gentleman violates a safety standard where somebody was killed earlier, and the arbitrator said he's an exemplary employee, long-term exemplary employee. He shouldn't have done that. Maybe there should be some sanction, but termination of employment is too serious a sanction. Mr. Nevsky never got that. After 22 years of going to work, being a great employee, he lost all that.
Frank, could I ask you about just a fact inquiry I have?
Sure.
There was a urinalysis conducted at 8:30 in the morning, and neither you or your opponents speak to the results. Do we have nothing in the record on that?
Oh, it was positive. It was negative. I get confused. It's negative as to drugs. It was only the urinalysis is done only to drug testing, and he was completely negative. I mean, it came back, and there was nothing there. Does that answer your question? I wasn't sure. Judge Reagan asked the same question at the district court. He said, can you do something with the urinalysis that would tell you about alcohol? And I think the answer is you can't. But that evidence isn't there.
Or not out of, apparently, because neither side has moved on that.
Right. Well, and by the time, how long they keep it and how long that's available, I don't know. It was certainly not there when I got into the case.
You want to save some time for rebuttal?
I do. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Barron. Mr. Cooper.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Ian Cooper, and I do represent ConocoPhillips, the employer of Mr. Nevsky in this case. And I think, Judge Wood, you already identified the key issues in the case. My colleague, Mr. Widmer, will be addressing from the perspective of the union the issues as to whether or not the 2004 SAP has just cause implications and the implications of the 2005 MOA. My point is very simple. It is undisputed in this case that Mr. Nevsky had a confirmed positive test for alcohol. The 2004 SAP says very clearly the person will be terminated in the event of a confirmed positive test.
But I guess the real, as I see this case, kind of cutting through everything, it's not so much that that is defined by now, by the 2004 policy, as just cause for termination. Had there not been the 2005 memorandum, one can grieve just cause. One can say it was a bad test, or one could say whatever you want to say. Now, if in the end the arbitrator said, indeed, it was 0.043, we rule for the company, he's out. But, I mean, there are all sorts of things. Stealing from the company, I'm sure, is probably another thing that you have reserved the right to terminate immediately for. At least you'd be a very unusual company if you didn't. But it doesn't mean there's no grievance process.
Well, I think that's the point, and maybe that's what you're getting at. But isn't there a distinction between whether or not there's a process available that you can go through and whether or not just cause is a live issue?
Well, there is, and I guess what he's saying, as I see it really, is, or at least to the extent I think there's a claim here maybe, it's a process claim. He was deprived because of the 2005 memorandum of the opportunity to go through an arbitrator and say whatever it is he may have had to say. That's what I was asking, trying to find out what he might have had to say.
To be more precise, though, he did have a process, because the 2005 MOA specifically says that thou shalt not grieve, except for matters relating to chain of custody.
I mean, the union makes an argument that I found pretty unpersuasive, that chain of custody is a synonym for all process, and I don't think so. I think chain of custody just means, you know, was it your breath that was recorded on the machine, or was it your blood and traced all the way through? At least that's what the evidence rules would normally mean.
Your Honor, how it would play out in terms of what chain of custody would be interpreted on appeal through grievance, I don't know. It hasn't been done, to my knowledge. But the point is if it's simply process or no process, process is available. The real point, though, is, and I think you asked this question, is maybe it is reasonable to say there's a zero-tolerance policy. Maybe someone would conclude reasonably. And let me tell you, when you represent someone who operates refineries and storage facilities with hundreds of thousands of gallons of volatile products that can blow up because an operator like Mr. Nemski comes in impaired, it's really reasonable to have a zero-tolerance policy. And that's what this case is about. This case is not about 20 years of exemplary service.
No, but, I mean, or at least it seems to me, given the clause in the CBA that allows ConocoPhillips to define work rules, the 2004 work rule that's defined and says we have a zero-tolerance policy, I don't really see that as being the essence of the challenge here. I take your point entirely. I mean, this is a workplace. I mean, you didn't want to be in the Exxon Valdez situation I realize we're not talking about tankers, but the same sort of thing. But I thought Mr. Nemski's real point was I never had a chance to show that I really wasn't impaired.
Well, with all due respect, I mean, first of all, a grievance was lodged on his behalf. Secondly, it was abandoned by the union. And thirdly, the evidence, so quote unquote, that has been proffered in this case is woefully lacking. You asked the question yourself, Your Honor. The time for disclosure of expert witnesses in this case has come and long gone. And during that time frame and all through discovery, we've heard the same thing. It's been basically Mr. Nemski's refrain, I can't understand this. Well, let me offer a couple of possible explanations. Mr. Nemski owns a bar called the Second Last Chance Saloon. He admits that he was drinking in the 12-hour period beforehand. He tells two or three different stories as to what he ingested during that period, whether it was two beers at the bar and then a couple more at home, and on and on and on. And one time it's Robitussin, the next time it's pipe cement on my boots. But all of it is speculation, and none of it is anything for this court to consider in terms of evidence. And that's what we're really talking about. Is there a triable issue of fact in this case? And there is not, because there is no evidence as to the issue of whether or not the man had a false positive. Nor is there anything in the record before this court challenging the procedure that was used by Nurse Diener. She's testified, we've got the affidavit also as well, that says very, very directly, we followed protocol to the letter. The whole notion that there's a plus or minus 0.005 variance is a complete red herring. Because, in fact, the machine that was used on Mr. Nemski was calibrated, not once, but twice, on the morning of the test. There's not one scintilla of evidence in this record that Mr. Nemski did not have a confirmed positive test. Now, the union entered into an MOA in 2005 that said game, set, and match, with the exception of chain of custody. And I think it would be highly inappropriate to now suggest that there's a tribal issue of fact for the employer to follow not only the SAP in 2004 and the MOA in 2005, but a confirmed positive test and say you get another chance. It's bad policy, and it's not the law. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Mr. Widmer?
Yes. Good morning, and may it please the Court. William Widmer representing Local 399. Judge Wood, let me begin by addressing your questions. First, the company's position, as found by Judge Reagan, not challenged by appellant, was, and this is at page 3, that the company opposed substantive arbitrability. It was the company's position that because the substance abuse policy arose outside the collective bargaining agreement, it was not subject to the grievance and arbitration procedure.
Yeah, see, that I'm not sure if that helps you, because it seems to me the company comes in with this policy in 2004, which they defend strongly that they had a right to create that policy. And then in 2005, there's this MOA signed by the union, signed by the company, which goes to it says what we're all saying it says. It applies to any employee, and it reserves arbitration for chain of custody issues.
Integrity of the chain of custody process is what it says.
All right. So, but it's fundamentally, it's focusing on chain of custody, as opposed to the entire testing process or anything
The union
else.
Views that fundamentally differently, and it would pursue that before an arbitrator.
Perhaps you would, but all I'm saying is that looks to me, since it's signed by both the union and the company, as at least de facto an amendment to the CBA. The CBA has arbitration proceedings, has grievance proceedings, and now this has carved out of the grievance proceedings one particular subject. I don't know if it's not an amendment to the CBA. I don't know how you could avoid arbitration.
It is, but you avoid arbitration because...
I mean generic arbitration.
I understand,
I'm
talking generic arbitration. It was the company's position throughout that the substance abuse policy was not subject to the grievance and arbitration provision. They, in fact, won that point in an arbitration in Texas that is Exhibit J to our 399's special appendix. In addition...
Now, how can that possibly be correct, though, since the CBA makes everything subject to grievance and arbitration?
Because the substance abuse, the employer's argument, this was their argument, and it's in the correspondence between the 9 craft unions, including Local 399, and the lawyers, that it was the company's policy that the substance abuse policy, because it was outside of the collective bargaining agreement, was not subject to the grievance and arbitration procedure. They maintained that. Mr. Cervone's letter is at pages 34 and 35, their attorney, at 399's supplemental appendix. They maintained that. In fact, one of the concerns the union had was when they filed their grievance protesting the unilateral change and they filed their unfair labor practice charge, they fully anticipated that the National Labor Relations Board would do what it normally does in those cases, and that's defer resolution of the unfair labor practice charge until the underlying grievance is resolved. The Labor Board did not do that. They dismissed it. The timeline is that the union files its grievance, it's processing its grievance. In October, the union business agent, and this is in the record, the union business agent reads a decision of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Sitco, which I would note in passing on that panel was Judge Cuddy of this court, where they overturned, but the test for arbitrary is what is the legal and factual landscape at the time of the union's action. The legal and factual landscape at the time of the union's action was their unfair labor practice charge was dismissed in a manner consistent with the company's position that the substance abuse policy was not
asserting it was an unfair, or the union, 399, was asserting it was an unfair labor practice because you thought that the company wasn't entitled to implement the substance abuse policy?
That's correct.
So that's, and I can easily see why you lose that, frankly. It seems to me that defines one type of just cause for firing somebody. It's a workplace safety measure. I can see all sorts of reasons why that would not be a winning argument.
But
I don't see why that ties in with it being, quote-unquote, outside the CBA, though, given that this CBA...
That's not the union's position. That's the employer's position. All I'm saying is the Labor Board's position was consistent with that. There's a court decision saying an employer has a unilateral right to implement a zero-tolerance policy over the union's objection.
That may be true. I don't see why that takes it out of the CBA if the CBA reserves to the employer.
The issue is not whether it's in or out of the CBA.
Yes,
the issue is...
if it's in the CBA, then the arbitration procedure still applies.
But the employer took the position. All of the conduct that the union saw at the time it entered into the memorandum of agreement was consistent with the union's position. The other nine unions surrendered rather than find out if it was substantively arbitral by withdrawing their grievance. Local 399 secured the unquestioned right to challenge the integrity of the process. Now, what I would submit is wholly irrational.
Of the chain of custody process.
But it's the process. That's correct. And,
well,
and as Judge Reagan pointed out...
As you said, we don't know what that means yet.
But so, as Judge Reagan pointed out, all of the issues that Mr. Nemski attempted to raise were process issues. And what you have, if you are saying that a union cannot, as Judge Reagan said, enter into a bright line agreement, that yes, at a refinery, inherently dangerous, where impaired workers could lead to a catastrophe, I submit it's not irrational. It is completely rational for a union to say, we are not going to permit someone to come to work impaired that can endanger the whole bargaining unit.
Okay, let me ask you this then. You think that the arbitration provision that you negotiated in 2005 allows all process issues to be arbitrated. What do you say then to Mr. Nemski's argument that the union was proceeding with arbitration until he filed his charge, at which point the one man said, well, you know, we dropped it because he filed his charges?
Judge Reagan...
I looked at that segment of the deposition, and it seemed to me that Judge Reagan's interpretation was tough to sustain.
Well, let me go back to the... And this is an issue raised on the blood test. In fact, the union instructed Mr. Nemski to get a blood test so they'd have objective evidence to challenge.
But how could he go if the company was...
Because the timeline is at 8:20. If you look at page 4, if you look at the bottom of page 4, Judge Reagan's memorandum of opinion, at 8:20, he's offered the taxicab. Taxicabs don't appear out of the air. Okay, call me a cab. At 8:30, he takes the urinalysis. Had he accepted the offer of the cab, he could have completed the urinalysis, gotten the cab, and got the blood test. He didn't do that.
But that doesn't answer my question, though, as to why a rational trier of fact might think that the union dropped the arbitration because he filed the complaint.
I don't believe that's a justifiable inference, but assuming, and I think Judge Reagan's analysis is correct, because it tears it from its sequence of events and the explanation. But you cannot breach the duty of fair representation by abandoning a grievance that lacks merit. The policy says you are gone for confirmed positives. The union said, yes, someone should be gone for confirmed positives. He had a confirmed positive. The union said, get a blood test. We're prepared to fight for you. He could have gotten the blood test. He could have easily gotten the blood test without running into any insubordination problems, and he failed to do that. And so on those facts, it was rational for the union to conclude it can't be
won. But why did it go so far then? The union knew all along that there was no blood test.
Unions always...
Step by step by step.
Because of...
It wasn't the blood test.
Because...
It wouldn't have started.
The reason it's processed, Your Honor, there are time limits... There are breach of the duty of fair representation suits. there are opportunities to settle cases. You process it to the last step, and then you decide whether or not to pursue it to arbitration. That's what happened here. It was abandoned because it lacked merit.
Thank you, Switzer. Mr. Barron?
I think we can look at opinions of this court where unions have abandoned grievances at the first step, and they take a look at them. I don't think that there's any indication, certainly nothing in this record that indicates that unions always take these, you know, right up to the door of arbitration. I don't know if there are questions the court have. I've only got a limited amount of time. I guess the one point I would make vis-a-vis the company is there's a lot of noise made about, you know, this being a refinery. There's all sorts of unsafe things in a refinery. Those are arguments that are made to a jury, to a finder of fact. The fact is Mr. Nemski testified under oath this is unreliable. He gave reasons that a finder of fact could discard the result of the breathalyzer. Ms. Denner did not testify that she followed the procedures to the T. In fact, she testified exactly the opposite. If she was going to follow him to the T, she would have been in that room with him. That's what it required. She left and violated the procedures by her own testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Barron.
Thanks
to all counsel.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement. And